Everybody, it's 11 o'clock, and thanks for joining us for the 71st episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Quick sub-disclaimer for you guys. I've picked up a bit of a summer cold this week, so if I excuse myself on the microphone, I beg your indulgence and apologize in advance because I am heavily coughing. So I'll try not to do that if I can help it. Before we begin our normal quick disclaimers, this show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you would, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Sure. I doubt any of our listeners who hear that would not know what that is, even if you grew up in a cave. that's from the 1965 recording Rubber Soul. It's a song called Norwegian Wood, and it's a song about an extramarital affair that John Lennon had on his wife at the time. And the reason that I played it is because we're talking about cluster B's tonight, and in cluster B-esque fashion, most people think that when the last verse is, you know, so I lit a fire, isn't it good, Norwegian Wood, and people assume that he's making a sexual reference. In the song, the last verse, and when I woke, I was alone, this bird had flown, which is a slang term for females in Britain. So the chick had left him, and he was all pissed off, so he burned her apartment down. literally. He lit a fire.
So that wasn't just a lyric, like he literally did this?
Yes. He admits to it. Oh, yeah.
Oh, fabulous. I actually had never heard that. So,
I know,
so thanks
and most
for,
people
for
haven't.
Yeah,
and that's very cluster B-like behavior, so I thought it would be a great intro for the show.
Yeah, that absolutely
yeah.
fits. Yeah, in a rather disturbing manner. So, as Dr. Matt
yeah, I know.
Mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled Cluster Bs, Narcissists, Antisocials, Histrionics, and Borderlines, Part 2, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Yeah. So you got kind of a earlier kind of bonus trivia. So tonight I'm going to talk about something that most people don't know. They've probably heard of it before. Maybe some people have, some people have. Most musicians have. So back in the 60s and 50s and 60s and 70s, and actually it started in the late 1920s, there was a music store in London called Selmer. And it was started by two brothers, Lou and Ben Davis, who actually started out selling saxophones from a French company. And the French company was called Selmer, ergo the title of their music store. They branched out and eventually added guitars and woodwinds and keyboards and brass and amplifiers and all kinds of stuff. But they started out essentially as a saxophone company. And then by the time they got into the 50s, they were adding Hofner guitars. And by the 60s, Gibsons and all sorts of stuff. And they at that point, they were located, I think, on Moore Street. And they relocated to Charing Cross Road, which at the time was in... kind of near the unofficial boundary of an area in London called Soho, which is where all the music shops and the, you know, it was a mecca for guitarists, and there was recording studios and managers' offices and clubs and all that kind of stuff in there. So it was an area ripe for a music store like Selmer's. And what they ended up, and the reason that it's become famous is because a lot of guys in the early stages. Either a lot of famous musicians either bought guitars there, sold guitars there, or worked there. So, for example, John McLaughlin of the Mahavishnu Orchestra worked there. Paul Kossoff of Free worked there. Peter Green and Jeff Beck all bought their original Les Pauls there. Eric Clapton bought his 335 there that he played all during the Blind Faith era and on the Goodbye Cream concerts at the Royal Albert Hall. Jimmy Page bought his first Les Paul there of Led Zeppelin, of the Yardbirds and Led Zeppelin. He bought his first Les Paul because he was playing Telecasters prior to that. And Steve Howe of Yes bought his first Gibson ES-175 there. So it was a well-trafficked place that a lot of folks went to back in the day. Albert Lee got his first Les Paul, even though Albert Lee has been playing Music Man for years and years and years and years and has been sponsored by them. He started out playing Les Pauls, and he got the first Les Paul from Selmer's music, albeit the fact that the band he was playing with bought him the Les Paul because he didn't have the money to pay for it, and they loved the sound that Eric Clapton got out of his Les Paul. And the reason Clapton got the Les Paul is because one of his heroes, Freddie King, played a Les Paul, and he's like, I got to get one of those. And so he's he actually in '65 bought the famous quote unquote Beano Les Paul Burst there, the guitar that he played on the John Mayall and the Blues Breakers featuring Eric Clapton record, the so-called Beano record. That's the Les Paul he played that he got from Selmer's. And because Freddie King, one of his heroes, played a gold top Les Paul, he couldn't find one, so he got this Sunburst Les Paul, and it's been tagged the Beano Burst ever since when he was playing with John Mayall. When he was rehearsing, when he left John Mayall and started rehearsing with Cream, the guitar was stolen, and nobody knows where it is. It's never been recovered. And Jeff Beck bought his first Les Paul there, I think in '66. So, I mean, a lot of these guys have been through the shop. Beatles bought gear there. Doug Ellis, one of the workers, was asked by one of the road crew from the Beatles to come to Paul McCartney's flat and bring a bunch of gear, and he played a bunch of gear there, and they bought a bunch of stuff from him. Jimi Hendrix came by, and who at one time owned a Gibson ES-330 that he sold to the store, and it ended up in the hands of Andy Summers, who was playing with a band called Zoot Mooney's Big Roll Band. That was prior to the Police, obviously. And so, I mean, this thing has just all kinds of history, connected to it. Jim Marshall, who, started Marshall Amplifiers, used to buy drum kits at Selmer's to sell to his drumming students, because Jim Marshall was originally a drummer and was a drum teacher before he started making amplifiers. Pete Townsend, when he's playing with the Detours prior to him getting the high numbers in The Who, bought his Fender Pro Amp from him. Mick Taylor, who's played with the Stones and John Mayall and done a lot of, just everybody else, he bought his first Les Paul from Selmer's. So this thing is just a landmark. And unfortunately, in the 70s, it was bought over, I don't know what time in the 70s, but a hi-fi business bought it out. And then it later became, a turnkey shop, which sold, recording gear. And then around 2008, 2009, developers bought it and flattened it and rebuilt it. And I think what exists there now is a Chipotle grill. So there's very few semblance of the remnants of the Selmer music, but that was a really landmark place that everybody who was anybody hung out there, bought gear from, traded gear, or worked there over the years. So I wanted to put a shout out to them because they really started a lot of folks' career. Jimmy Page brought his Dan Electro there also. So there you have it.
Got it. Okay. Thank you very much for that. Okay. Again, we will be taking calls from listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until around midnight. So feel free to give us a call. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. Tonight's show is called Cluster Bees, Narcissists, Antisocials, Histrionics, and Borderlines, Part 2. Tonight is a continuation of our last show on this same topic, which turned out to be full of more information than we could handle in 1 hour, so we extended the remainder to tonight's show. Most of us have heard several of these mental health disorder terms thrown around in social media and pop culture media, but few laypersons have a very accurate understanding of what they mean and the appropriate times to use them or not use them. We have covered bits and pieces of all these pathologies in prior episodes, but have never previously dedicated an entire show just to the famous cluster Bs, which are one of the most often discussed mental health topics that we have covered on this show, aside from depression and suicide. Then we will talk about coping with persons who have any of the four diagnoses within the cluster. So tonight we will discuss a continued understanding of the four cluster B disorders, and we'll pick up starting with histrionics. And then we will talk about how to cope with cluster B disorders as someone who has one or as someone who has a loved one who has one. And I will check in with you, Dr. Mathis, before we get started and see if there's anything that you want to bring up before we get going.
Nope, I'm good. Thanks.
All right. So let me pick up with just a tiny snip from last time so we can reorient our listeners back into the paragraph. We were covering an understanding of the four cluster B disorders, and this is a continuation. So we were getting into a detailed discussion of each, and we had covered two of them. So we've talked about antisocial personality disorder and borderline personality disorder last week, and that's where we paused. So we are going to pick up now talking about histrionic personality disorder. So histrionic personality disorder is a disorder characterized by a pattern of excessive attention-seeking emotions, usually beginning in early adulthood, including inappropriately seductive behavior and an excessive need for approval. People with HPD have a high need for attention, make loud and inappropriate appearances, exaggerate their behaviors and emotions, and crave stimulation. They may exhibit sexually provocative behavior, express strong emotions with an impressionistic style, and can be easily influenced by others. Associated features include egocentrism, self-indulgence, continuous longing for appreciation, and persistent manipulative behavior to achieve their own needs. Pardon me just a moment. Brief cough break. People with HPD are usually high functioning, both socially and professionally. They usually have good social skills, despite tending to use them to manipulate others into making them the center of attention. HPD may also affect a person's social and romantic relationships, as well as their ability to cope with losses or failures. Individuals with HPD often fail to see their own personal situation realistically, instead dramatizing and exaggerating their difficulties. They may go through frequent job changes as they become easily bored and may prefer withdrawing from frustration instead of facing it. Because they tend to crave novelty and excitement, they may place themselves in risky situations. All these factors may lead to greater risk of developing clinical depression. Studies have shown that there is a strong correlation between the function of neurotransmitters and the cluster B personality disorders, such as HPD. Individuals diagnosed with HPD have highly responsive noradrenergic. Thank you.
Noradrenergic.
I'm going to leave that to you. What Dr. Mathis said, because I'm coughing too much tonight to get that straight, which is responsible for the synthesis, storage, and release of the neurotransmitter norepinephrine. High levels of norepinephrine lead to anxiety proneness, dependency, and high sociability. And I believe they mean that in a negative context. Additional characteristics may include a need to be the center of attention, excessively emotional, dramatic, or sexually provocative to gain attention. Pardon me a moment. Being easily influenced by others, especially those who treat them approvingly. Being overly dramatic and emotional, shallow, rapidly changing emotions. Blaming personal failures or disappointments on others. Constant seeking of reassurance or approval, excessive sensitivity to criticism or disapproval, excessive concern with physical appearance, exhibitionist behavior, inappropriately seductive appearance or behavior of a sexual nature, low tolerance for frustration or delayed gratification, making rash decisions, pride of own personality and unwillingness to change, viewing any change as a threat. Rapidly shifting emotional states that may appear superficial or exaggerated to others. Speaks dramatically with strong opinions, but few facts or details to back them up. Thinks relationships with others are closer than they really are. Or using somatic symptoms of physical illness to garner attention. Although it is said that the history of histrionic personality disorder stems from the word hysteria. Actually, it comes from the Etruscan histrio, which means an actor. Hysteria can be described as an exaggerated or uncontrollable emotion that people, especially in groups, experience. And then here I'm going to pause and check in with you, Dr. Mathis, see if there's anything you'd like to add.
Yeah, first of all, I have the same comment I have with the other ones. This, you can see this in late childhood, early adolescence. They get uberly dramatic early on. Secondly, it also comes from the Greek histolovio, which means wondering womb, because it's the way that Hippocrates described women getting histrionic during, quote-unquote, that time of the month, because he believed that their wombs detached and wandered around their body, which is why they bled. Yeah. The other, which
Alrighty
is why
then.
The women's, which is why the women's movement lobbied to get it changed from hysterical personality disorder to histrionic, ergo the actor. Because when it used to be called hysterical personality disorder, after the histrio, which is why they changed it to histrionic, to the Etruscan actor, because it was less, quote unquote, sexist. Well, read my tongue. Guys have it too. It's just as ugly when guys have it. The other thing I would say is you'll see a lot of people who have a post-traumatic stress disorder will develop histrionic personality disorder, not for the same reasons as people who have it normally, if you will, have it, but because they expect things to go from 0 to 100 in a heartbeat, and they're expecting the worst to happen, waiting for the shoe to fall, and they just get all bent out of shape really, really easily. And they have a lot of histrionic tendencies, not because they have what most people would consider to be a quote-unquote genuine type of histrionic personality disorder.
Okay, thank you for that.
Sure.
All right. The last one that we want to talk about is narcissistic personality disorder. So people with narcissistic personality disorder, NPD, are characterized by persistent grandiosity, excessive need for admiration, and a personal disdain and lack of empathy for others. As such, the person with NPD usually displays arrogance and a distorted sense of superiority, and they seek to establish abusive power and control over others. Self-confidence, a strong sense of self, is different from narcissistic personality disorder. People with NPD typically value themselves over others to the extent that they openly disregard the feelings and wishes of others and expect to be treated as superior regardless of their actual status or achievements. Moreover, the person with NPD usually exhibits a fragile ego, self-concept, intolerance of criticism, and a tendency to belittle others in order to validate their own superiority. They often take advantage of the people around them. The behavior typically begins by early adulthood and occurs across a variety of social situations. The cause of NPD is unknown. The DSM-5 indicates that persons with NPD usually display some or all of the following symptoms, typically without the commensurate qualities or accomplishments: arrogance, consistently demeans, bullies, and belittles others, envy of others or belief that others envy you, exaggeration of achievements or talents, expectation of constant praise and admiration, exploitation of others to achieve personal gain, fixation on fantasies of power, success, intelligence, attractiveness, etc. Grandiosity with expectations of superior treatment from other people. Intense envy of others and the belief that others are equally envious of them. Self-perception of being unique, superior, and associated with high-status people and institutions. Sense of entitlement to special treatment and to obedience from others, unreasonable expectations of favors and advantages, often taking advantage of others, or an unwillingness to empathize with the feelings, wishes, and needs of other people. And here I will pause and check in with Dr. Mathis.
Okay, same comments. You can see this in beginning in late childhood, early adolescence. The other thing is all of these personalities, those are highly genetically loaded, and we know that already. Just because you have the genetic loading doesn't mean you're going to develop them. Usually, it's like a crapshoot. And, of course, if you have it on both sides, there's a much higher likelihood you're going to develop it. But usually what happens is there is a coexistence of the genetic predisposition and then a series of environmental events that sort of push the brain over its ability to cope with stuff, almost like a trauma kind of thing. And you'll see people reverting to the cluster B personality disorders because they just don't have the equipment to deal with stuff. And that's their fallback, is this kind of thing. It's very, you almost never see this with somebody who doesn't have one or more family members that has a cluster B in it somewhere. It doesn't have to be a parent, but it can be a grandparent or a cousin or whatever, but it is genetically, all cluster Bs are genetically loaded.
I'm curious what your opinion is as to why most of the information that I was able to find doesn't seem to want to point at early adolescence presence of these things.
Because adolescent folks buy in, well, that's a great question, because adolescent folks in general are very unstable. And if you're not careful and you're not a clinician who deals with teenagers a lot, you will mistake quote-unquote normally exaggerated hormonally driven teenage angst and behaviors as a personality disorder. So you have to look at any, and this is true of any group, you have to look at them relative to the quote-unquote normal peer in their age and gender. So if you don't deal with a lot of teenagers and you see one coming across and they may be very dramatic and histrionic and they may be a theater person, or they may just be real excited, or they may be ADHD and on drugs, or, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that teenagers get personality disordered-esque behaviors that don't meet the criteria for being a full-blown personality disorder. So I think a lot of folks don't want to give the clinician, for lack of a better term, armament to start thinking about this as early as late childhood. But I can tell you that I've seen plenty of them that are this in late childhood, early adolescence. Of the ones that I've seen, I'm not suggesting I've seen a boatload of these folks in adolescence and late children. I'm just saying when it's there, it's really obvious if you deal with this population on a regular basis, as I do. It's really obvious when you've got a normal teenager who's just being the moody, sullen, emotional, you know, bipolar-esque, you know, type teenager because of, you know, hormones or food or excitement or whatever, as opposed to somebody who has a genuine personality disorder.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you for that.
Sure.
Okay, so speaking of pulling this apart and understanding it, the next thing that we want to talk about is how to cope with cluster B disorders as someone who has one, or as someone who has a loved one who has one. So now let's talk about each of these disorders in terms of the reality of treatment, coping with daily life, having this disorder, and or supporting a loved one who has it. Pardon me a moment. Oh, this coughing thing. Okay. So the first one we want to cover is antisocial personality disorder. So ASPD is considered to be among the most difficult personality disorders to treat. Rendering an effective treatment for ASPD is further complicated due to the inability to look at comparative studies between psychopathy and ASPD due to differing diagnostic criteria, differences in defining and measuring outcomes, and a focus on treating incarcerated patients rather than those in the community. Because of their very low or absent capacity for remorse, individuals with ASPD often lack sufficient motivation and fail to see the costs associated with antisocial acts. They may only simulate remorse rather than truly commit to change. They can be seductively charming and dishonest and may manipulate staff and fellow patients during treatment. Studies have shown that outpatient therapy is not likely to be successful. But the extent to which persons with ASPD are entirely unresponsive to treatment may have been exaggerated. Most treatment is for those in the criminal justice system to whom the treatment regimens are given as part of their imprisonment. Those with ASPD may stay in treatment only as required by an external source, such as parole conditions. So a couple questions for you, Dr. Mathis. First, and
sure,
we'll probably go through the same pattern with each of the four groups.
Okay.
First, what do we need to know about being someone with ASPD?
Well, if you are someone with ASPD, you probably don't know it and you would not admit it. Very, very few people with that disorder are willing to admit that they have it. Same thing with the quote-unquote psychopathy thing. Most of those folks won't admit it. I've only run into a few people who go, yep, I'm the monster your mom warned you about. I mean, it's very, very few of those folks will do that. Most of them are completely unaware of it, and when you corner them on it, they get very defensive and very unhappy, and some of them will actually kill you, literally.
Wow.
You don't have to kill somebody to have ASPD. All you have to do is transgress major societal boundaries, interfering with the course of justice such that it impacts negatively a large group of people, stealing large sums of money and blaming it on everybody else and having no remorse about it, this fact that the person is homeless. You know, you don't really have to kill somebody. Most people think of ASPD folks as people like Charles Manson, John Wayne Gacy, Richard Ramirez, and those people all had it, but there are also people in the population that have it that you would go, oh, really? Uh-huh. All you have to do is look at their behavior.
Yeah.
And they clearly qualify. I mean, I've got a friend that's a quote-unquote friend, somebody I know who definitely has ASPD. There is no two ways about it.
Yeah. It's something our listeners may want to do. I don't have the episode right in front of me, but we did an episode a couple years ago about Hollywood chic and how these things are portrayed in the media movies.
Yeah, they're glorified a lot.
Versus
yeah.
the reality. Mm-hmm. And you guys may want to go back to that episode and listen to the part about the cluster
yeah.
Bs and how they're portrayed versus the reality, because that's going to be part of it. I mean, those people were real that you just mentioned, but they were definitely glorified in media, and there were biopics made of them and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
And most cluster Bs who are good looking and or who have good social skill sets get away with it for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And never get hauled in to face their stuff. It's amazing to me.
Yeah.
That happens. I'm sorry?
I said a lot of them have high charisma.
And a lot of them have high political power, and nobody wants to muck with them. Or they go, oh, they're so cute. They really didn't mean to do it. Yes, they did.
Yeah.
There is nothing behind the mask except the mask. When you take the mask away, it's the demon in the picture of, the picture of Dorian Gray. It's just the mask. And when you take the mask away, it's the demon in the picture.
Fair enough. Okay, so second question. What do we need to know about being someone who has a loved one or a family member with ASPD?
Run, Forrest, run.
That may be wise, but what if you can't? What if you're a blood relative or something?
Then you stay as far away from them as you can. You don't get into any business deals with them. You don't trust a single thing. You know, it's kind of like the old joke about lawyers. How do you know when a lawyer's lying? His lips are moving. How do you know when an ASPD person's lying? Their lips are moving. You can't believe a damn thing they say. You can't trust them ever. You can't believe anything they say, ever. They have a very low cure rate because they don't think there's anything wrong with them, and they have no conscience. They have no core, very much like most of the other cluster Bs. And because of that, they have no remorse about what they do, and they blame everybody else for their stuff. So they take no responsibility for the chaos that they cause, for the most part.
So if, like, a person has a family member or a partner like that, and they think, well, if I could only just do X, they're pretty much self-delusional because it's too painful
they're
to realize.
They're completely delusional. The only thing that you can do that we know, as far as I'm aware of the research studies, the only thing you can do is you can control their behaviors if you incarcerate them, or if you can control their money. And you're not really changing them. Or to quote, you know, if I were going to do my Andy Rooney, you're not really changing anything. you got to love that guy. You're not really changing anything. All you're doing is controlling their behavior. And as soon as you don't control their finances, they go there. You know, they're bad boys running wild. my horrible claws, my imitation for the Scorpions.
And the sound effects.
Yeah,
okay.
You can only control them as long as you have them incarcerated or, under threat of incarceration, or if you control their money.
Okay. And then, so related, what is the likelihood of this pathology ever improving over time with certain conditions or therapies or anything?
Very, very slim and none. The success rate for therapy with these folks is extremely dismal. It, you know, because most of them don't think there's anything wrong with them. They don't want therapy. So if you're not invested in changing, why would they change? The only thing they're going to do is get smarter about how they fool a therapist. And they're real good at that. And because they use the same type of skill sets to manipulate other people to get ahead in business or to have multiple sexual liaisons or affairs or embezzle money or whatever. It's the same skill set. And, of course, the better looking they are and the smoother talker they are, the more they get away with stuff.
Okay. And our listeners should pay attention to the fact that these four pathologies seem on the surface, you know, at first blush, like they're different. But when you start to pick them apart, you're going to see how these threads are common to all four of them, just in different forms, different ways, different amounts.
Well, the common thread to all of them is none of them really have a core. And all of them, their central theme is drama. And it's, you know, I joke about it being all the world's a stage and I'm the principal actor in it. And if I'm not, I'm going to make damn sure I am by some kind of drama, whether it's death, dismemberment, embezzlement, sexual acting out, drug acting out, faux suicide gestures, you know, showing up in silky nightgowns or speedos at the beach if you're a hunk guy or whatever. I mean, it's, you know, you're going to be the center of attention. Yeah. And usually, from a gender perspective, you usually see narcissists and antisocials being male, although there certainly are female counterparts to that, just as there are male counterparts to borderlines and histrionics. But the vast majority of them, of the borderlines and histrionics, are female, and the vast majority of narcissists and antisocials are male in the general population.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So then, speaking of borderlines, that will be our next one. So BPD is typically treated with therapy such as cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. Another type,
right.
Dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, may reduce the risk of suicide if it comes to that. Therapy may occur one-on-one or in a group. While medications do not cure BPD, they may be used to help with the associated symptoms. Some people require care in hospital. And there's an ongoing debate about the naming of the disorder, especially the suitability of the word borderline. Some mental health professionals may be reluctant to take on borderlines because it is not unusual for them, more so than the other pathologies, to become contentious with their counselors, even threatening them when given a diagnosis or instructions they do not like. Some even go so far as to harass their counselors or specifically harass them in court or via attorneys.
That's actually common.
Yeah. So number one, what do we need to know about being someone with BPD, if they'll even listen?
BPD people resent you calling them that for the most part. Now, some of them don't, but the vast majority do. They don't want to admit they are, and then they want to argue with you about it. I'm one of the few people in town who will treat cluster B personality disorders, and my colleagues think I'm crazy, and I probably am. They have a high propensity to call licensing boards and make up all kind of crazy crap about you, that you had sex with them in the office, that you raped them, that you embezzled money from them because they got mad at you. And if they get mad at you, they see that as justification to punish you, to get revenge on you. All the cluster Bs are like that, minus the histrionics. So most of the folks won't, most counselors will not take on cluster Bs, and they'll make up all kinds of excuses. Oh, I'm too busy. Oh, it's not in my skill set. Bullshit. They're chicken shit. They don't want to deal with the risk. And I really can't blame them. But, you know, my response to them is, okay, if you're not going to treat these people, who the hell do you think is going to treat them, and how the hell do you think they're going to get help? So I have very little patience with my colleagues who want to blow these folks off. They are difficult. They are a major pain in the ass. I'm just being honest, and I'm not slamming them. I'm really not. Most folks with PDP, I'll get it out right in a minute. Borderline
BPD.
Personality disorder, that's easier for me to say.
Okay.
have had early and pretty severe trauma as children. So this is a coping, quote-unquote, coping reaction to pretty severe trauma, usually prior to age 8 or 9 or 10. And the earlier the trauma, the more the brain gets miswired, and the harder this kind of thing is to treat. So when you combine a family history predisposition for cluster Bs coupled with traumatic kinds of events, particularly early on, BPD is pretty common. And it's really sad. and I say that with all sincerity, it's a really sad thing to do, even though they're a major pain in the butt, and they will test you and try you, and, you know, they are very, very, they're very disturbed folks, and it's just sad, because most of these folks are created out of really nasty trauma, and it's just, it's really, really sad, but at the same time, they are so traumatized, and it's their go-to defense mechanism, they're very reluctant to give it up. They do the same thing with themselves. That's part of the reason you'll see BPDs often have a history of cutting. That's very, very common. When the guys have it, they usually are burners. They'll put cigars and cigarettes out on themselves. Both genders will often do hair pulling, trichotillomania, and eating disorders are extremely common as children and adolescents with somebody with BPD. Very common.
Wow.
Yeah,
so,
it's a very serious. It's a serious deal. It's probably the second most difficult personality disorder, second to antisocial, to treat.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you verified something that has been a layman's personal theory of mine for a while, that BPD was associated with some form of childhood abuse. And I don't run into a lot of documentation verifying this, but I've been pretty sure of it.
No, that's absolutely true. That doesn't mean that you can't get borderline personality disorder without having trauma, but the norm is to have trauma, and it's usually pretty early on, and it's usually pretty nasty stuff. It's not like, oh, gee, I didn't get, you know, a popsicle for Christmas.
Like I saw mommy stabbing Santa Claus, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I saw Santa Claus being raped by Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
And I know we're being cute, but in reality, the things that they saw probably were not very cute at all. So
yeah.
So related to that, what do we need to know about being someone who has a loved one or a family member with BPD?
The same comment I have about antisocial. Run, Forrest, run. Don't believe the thing they say. Don't trust them. Make them prove everything, make them hold the line, don't give in to them, don't allow them any leeway. It's real sad, but if you acquiesce to their crap, what you're doing is reinforcing their pathology. And if you have somebody you really care about, encourage them to get help for that. You can get help for borderline personality disorder. Medications are not the solution. The only reason that people give medications, frankly, is to shut them up, which is ridiculous. They give medications because BPDs often have comorbid anxiety and depression when they don't get what they want, and when they're stressed out and freaking out, and they're acting out suicide gestures are very common. Marilyn Monroe was theorized to be a borderline, and that her suicide was actually accidental. It was one of her acting out sessions, because she'd had four or five gestures prior to that and had the phone by her side, just like she did in the bed when they found her. And it's theorized that she took so much medication she waited too long to call to do her little histrionic, oh, Lordy, I'm killing myself kind of crap, and that she ended up accidentally killing herself. She has there's a long history of that with her. So if you have somebody, make sure, you know, encourage them to get help, because it is helpful. It is workable. And one of the cognitive therapies, whether it's cognitive behavioral, rational emotive, dialectic behavior, which are all different versions of the same thing, basically, get somebody into therapy, because you're looking at 3 to 5 years of intensive one-on-one long-term therapy. And sometimes, usually at the end of the first couple of years, they'll move into a group setting as a secondary kind of level, so that they're getting feedback from other people in the group about their impact on the social milieu, because they typically, they're not real good about that.
So I've got a related question that I didn't put in the script notes.
Okay.
Something that I have observed with a couple of people that I've known personally. So these are anecdotal.
Okay.
So persons who are in a relationship with a BPD person, and I see a lot of corollary between them and persons who are with an abuser in the same realm of being unable to leave, being unable to have authority over yourself. You know, it's not an equal partnership. The BPD person runs everything. It's, you know, you
absolutely
have to acquiesce.
They're in charge. Yep.
And how do you deal with the person who is the partner who won't leave someone like that? Do you have to let them drown? Or, like, what is the
I
best
tell,
practice?
I tell, them you're I tell them you're choosing to be miserable because that's the truth. You can leave. You're choosing to be miserable. I put it back on them because they're responsible for it.
Mm-hmm.
They need to get out or their partner needs to get therapy. And they need to separate until their partner gets therapy if they really want to protect themselves. But usually what you'll see with somebody with BPD is if they choose correctly, quote-unquote, and I'm being a little facetious, they'll typically either hook up with somebody with dependent personality disorder, which is a cluster C personality disorder, the same one my personality disorder falls under, or they'll get up with a narcissist. And so the two most common pairings you'll get is a hot-looking borderline physiologically and a high-powered or very rich narcissist. And so the borderline becomes a reflection of the, you know, a narcissistic reflection of the narcissist, and the borderline gets her projective, usually a female borderline and a male narcissist, and the borderline gets her a projective identification through the narcissist. And I'm with a, you know, a powerful guy, therefore I'm powerful. The other one the other one that I call, you know, it's kind of like the Rodney Dangerfield comment on back to school when he's having, excuse me, when he's having dinner with the English teacher, the Sally Carrollman character, and you know, she says, "What happened to your two marriages?" And he said, "Oh, my first wife, you know, I really loved her, and the second wife, she was on the rebound, you know, I was an earth sign, she was a water sign, together we made mud." And that's kind of what a borderline and a narcissist are like. The other muddy relationship is a borderline with a dependent personality disordered male. And that's because the male won't leave the borderline. He'll do everything the borderline wants. I've seen several of those in therapy. The husband or the male partner will come in, and I'll go, "Dude, you're with a borderline. Hello, wake up, get a clue." They'll come in for couples counseling, and I'll do testing on both of them. And I'm like, "Ooh, this is bad." You know, and if they want to get better, that's great. But most of the time what the borderline wants is this continued acquiescence of the dependent personality disorder person. So,
got it. Okay.
But the borderlines they are certainly treatable. I don't want to throw my hands up and go just shoot them, which is kind of what I would do with an antisocial. Oops, did I say that? That was my unmedicated voice. Borderlines are certainly treatable.
Not professional voice.
Yeah. Yeah. Borderlines are certainly treatable, but they require long-term therapy, and they've got to accept their stuff, and they've got to work on it, and it's really hard for them, and it's really long, and it's two steps up and three steps back, and, you know, that kind of thing. And most of them get frustrated and drop out because they really don't want to be called on their stuff any more than narcissists or antisocials do. So.
Fair enough. And related to that, so what is the likelihood of this pathology ever improving over time with certain conditions or therapies?
If they put their mind to it, if they stick with it, it is absolutely treatable. But they've really got to stick with it. But it is treatable.
And they're not prone to.
Absolutely treatable. Yeah. It is absolutely treatable. And I never recommend them go on medication because all that does is dull the symptoms and allows them to continue on with their BS. You're putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound.
Got it. Okay, so let's focus on histrionic personality disorder. So treatment is often prompted by depression associated with dissolved romantic relationships. Medication does little to affect the personality disorder, but may be helpful with symptoms such as depression. Treatment for HPD itself involves psychotherapy, including cognitive therapy. So,
yep.
Question number one again, what do we need to know about being someone with HPD?
It's very draining on your body, and it really takes a toll on your adrenal system and your hormonal system, and it leads to all sorts of real physical body symptoms as you age because you're stressing out. You're doing your stress hormones constantly. You know, I jokingly call histrionic personality disorder Prissy syndrome. Prissy is the African-American character on a Gone with the Winds. Long this you know, and you know, Scarlett slaps her to get her back to square one, so to speak. That's what histrionics are doing inside all the time. And it's really, really bad for just about every organ system in your body. So, you know, if you've got HPD, get into treatment to save yourself a life history of debilitating physical issues. Most of the histrionics are mostly just dangerous to themselves. They you know, people get put out with them and they're like, okay, I'm sick of the drama, and you know, they leave them, and you know, they're not, you know, they're not bad people. The other three are questionable in terms, you know, it's, I joke about them being in a cluster B, and the B stands for bad and kind, to quote Mr. Mackey on South Park. But usually when I talk about the quote-unquote bad cluster Bs, histrionics get left out of that because they're basically bad for themselves, but they don't do damage to other people most of the time. They're inconvenient, and they're kind of a pain in the tush, and they can be embarrassing from time to time, but they are not mean-spirited or hateful kinds of folks. The other three, I can't say that about.
Okay, so that's good. That's a good distinction to bear in mind.
Yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
Okay, so what do we need to know about being someone who has a loved one or family member with HPD?
Well, again, see if you can get them into some kind of cognitive, behavioral, dialectic behavior kind of therapy. It's not, you know, the stress management is really good for these folks. Mindfulness is really good. Mindfulness is great for borderlines also. I've used that a lot. That's part of the DBT stuff. DBT is sort of cognitive behavioral therapy mixed with meditation / Eastern mindfulness kinds of stuff. And it's really good for those folks. It helps them to be present with their crazy stuff and not act on it. And the same thing is true with the histrionics. And it is... histrionics a lot quicker fix. They're going to be in and out a lot quicker than the other three. So it's a highly treatable, highly workable disorder. And like with anything else, the earlier you get in, the sooner you get out. You know, and all three of these are not like wine. They don't get better with time. They're like cancer.
Got
so
it.
The sooner you can get in and deal with them, the better off you're going to be.
Okay, so then that relates to, you know, the third question, what is the likelihood of this pathology ever improving over time with certain conditions or therapies?
Yeah, it's very improvable. Absolutely.
And so probably of the four, this is the one with the highest chance of being able to
absolutely.
Turn it around a little bit.
Absolutely.
Okay.
By the way, you'll see a lot of ADHD people with histrionic traits, if not full-blown histrionic personality disorder.
And why is that?
Because they think they're going to fail, and the least little thing happens, they're like, I'm just going to move the belt, and fill in the blank. Because they have a history of failing, and they expect to fail, and the ADHD people don't really want to change. They want the world to change for them for the most part. And so they develop histrionics because they expect to fail, and then the least little thing happens, and they freak out, and that's part of the reason they do drugs, is to calm themselves down or to dissociate from the emotion. So it's a really common comorbid condition. I'm not saying they have a full-blown personality disorder, but they some of them do, but they certainly have histrionic traits. That's pretty common for ADHD people, male and female.
Interesting. Okay. All right.
Which, of course, just regulates their brain, which makes them less able to think and less able to process, which stresses them out more, which makes them more, you know, it's this horrible cycle, you know.
Okay, so let's go to the narcissist. So therapy is often difficult, as people with the disorder frequently do not consider themselves to have a problem. Now, as we've discussed already, that's not unique to narcissists, but it's pretty heavy. Narcissistic personality disorder is rarely the primary reason for people seeking mental health treatment. When people with NPD enter treatment, it is typically prompted by life difficulties or to seek relief from another disorder, such as major depressive disorder, substance use disorders, bipolar or eating disorders, or at the insistence of relatives and friends. This is partly because individuals with NPD generally have poor insight and fail to recognize their perception and behavior as inappropriate and problematic due to their very positive self-image. Treatment for NPD is centered around psychotherapy. No medications are indicated for treating NPD, but may be used to treat co-occurring mental conditions or symptoms that may be associated with it, such as depression, anxiety, and impulsiveness, if present. The effectiveness of psychotherapeutic and pharmacological interventions in the treatment of NPD has yet to be systematically and empirically investigated. So maybe that's a good paper for somebody to write. Hint, hint, you know, professionals who may be listening. Clinical practice guidelines for the disorder have not yet been created, another hint, And current treatment recommendations are largely based on theoretical psychodynamic models of MPD and the experiences of clinicians with affected individuals in clinical settings. The presence of MPD in patients undergoing psychotherapy for the treatment of other mental disorders is associated with slower treatment progress and higher dropout rates. Okay, so question number one, what do we need to know about being someone with MPD?
Well, if you are, go get treatment before you do any more damage than you've already done. I had a buddy who used to call, who used to say, when I explained to him what narcissistic personality disorder it was, because my father had it, he goes, "Oh, you mean they think they're hot shit and they're not even warm diarrhea?" Which I thought was a hoot, and I have stolen that line from him ever since. That was 30 years ago. My little thing is they're legends in their own mind, but in nobody else's. So if you have NPD, check yourself into counseling before you do any more damage than you've already done, because I guarantee you, you've got a line of damaged body, so to speak, in the wake of your presence.
You got another thing coming.
Yeah. They are equally as difficult or in a different way to treat as borderlines are.
Sounds like for similar reasons, you know, basically it's hard to get them to agree they need to go.
Yeah, and usually they agree to go because somebody else is saying, you know, Lassie, get therapy or I'm getting the hell out or you're going to be fired from your job or, you know, and I've had a lot of that. People coming in.
Or I'm leaving you, you never see kids, blah, blah, blah.
They're under duress, you know, or they're using substances because they're trying to mask their disappointment when they don't get their grandiosity met. Or they're depressed because they don't get their grandiosity met or whatever, right?
Got it. Okay, so what do we need to know about being someone who has a loved one or family member with MPD? You know,
don't
do these ultimatums work?
Yeah, same thing with antisocials and borderlines. Run, Forrest, run, and if you can't run or you won't run or whatever, don't put up with their stuff. You have to confront them every single time they mess up. And that's the same thing you have to do with the borderlines and the antisocials. You have to confront them on every single thing. And when I said that to my mom, she goes, "Oh, my God, I'd be doing that 30 times a day." I said, "Well, you and Dad already scream and yell and fight like a bunch of, you know, cotton field, you know, field hands in the back, you know, with a third grade education. Oh, so how would that be any different?" She gave me a dirty look. And I love my mom, but she was histrionic as hell. I mean, nobody else would put up with my dad. I mean, let's face it. No offense to either of them, right? You can't take any of their crap. You have to call them on their crap every 5 minutes. And, of course, what that means is you're going to have a big blow-up, and it's going to be a constant conflict-habituated scenario, just like it was with my parents.
Yeah.
So if you're into that, and there's people who like that, and, you know, if you're one of those folks, get into a relationship with a narcissist and then call them on their stuff every single time, and you'll have more conflict than you can shake a stick at.
And so I guess the thing to bear in mind with most of these, if you're a partner or somebody or a family member or somebody like that, you know, you have to be prepared to issue the ultimatums and with the understanding that they may call you on your bluff and not go and cause you to have to move out or kick them out or divorce them or whatever the ultimatum
or cut off relationships with them if you're a cousin or an uncle or whatever. Yes. And you can't believe them, you can't trust them. They're very manipulative, just like the borderlines and the antisocials. That's why I call those three the bad ones. And I mean no disrespect to those folks, I really don't. But it's just a horrible disorder. I mean, all three of them are horrible disorders.
Pardon me. Okay.
Sure.
So last question. What is the likelihood of this pathology ever improving over time with certain conditions or therapies?
If they'll put themselves into it and really do it, they can get better. But it's a really long road. It's like with the borderlines. It's a really long road. Borderlines and narcissists can both get better if they want to, but most of the time they don't. I mean, it's really hard. And in fairness to both of them, it's really, really difficult because most of them wait way too long to come into therapy. The most successful treatment of borderlines, and I've only had a few over the years, maybe four or five total, and I've been doing this since 83. Even as a student, I was volunteering and stuff. I've seen a shoot ton of cluster Bs, and I've seen maybe four or five, excuse me, borderlines who were successfully, quote-unquote, treated, and three of them were under the age of 20 when they started, and one of them was under the was 15 when they started. And the earlier you start, the quicker you are. And those folks really, I mean, to their credit, they really held their own feet to the fire. They really did what they had to do. They faced their crap. They did it. They struggled. They cried. They screamed. They yelled. But they did it. And they were very successful. And I tell everybody that. You can do it, but you've got to really put your mind to it, and you've got to really work it. And you can't be fiddle-farting around, and you can't be trying to pull your crappy games and this kind of junk. And most of them aren't willing to do that because they're really scared. All cluster B people, particularly the three quote-unquote bad ones, are basically little kids. They're using infantile defense mechanisms. So if you think of them, you know, I tell somebody, when you're interacting with a cluster B, particularly a narcissist or a borderline or an antisocial, but the antisocials are usually smarter about their stuff, but not always, you know, and they have one of their episodes, ask yourself, what developmental age does the person that is having the episode feel like to you? Do they feel like a 10-year-old? Do they feel like an 8-year-old? Do they feel like a 14-year-old? That's the age they really are. That's their emotional age. And you have to treat them accordingly. You have to assume they're going to do the behavior of someone who's 8 or 10 or 14. You can't treat them like a 30 or 40 or 50-year-old. They're not that in their head. They're not.
Got it. No, and this is why we ask these questions. I know some of our listeners are probably a little worried about what they're going to have to do, but this is,
yeah,
you know.
And it's hard
we're not
on family
pull any
members
punches.
Or the lovers or the wives or the husbands. You know, it's really flipping hard, and I feel bad for those folks. But honestly, if you stay in a relationship with these people, you are a glutton for punishment, unless you just don't have any money and they have somehow convinced you to sign over all your money and control to them, which is not uncommon with some of these folks, and you're just stuck, and it is not a good situation.
Got it. Okay, I'm gonna check in with you one more time, real quick, before we get ready to wrap up the show, and see if there's anything that you want to add about anything that we've been discussing tonight in general on this topic.
I would just say that if you are a person suffering from one of these disorders, get help as soon as you can. If you know somebody that you love that has one of these, encourage them to get help. Bug the heck out of them to get help. Plead, yell, scream, cry, do whatever you have to, and if they won't, get the hell out. Or at least if you can't, abandon any delusion that you may have that you're going to have a real relationship with them, because you can't. And it's not because you're unable to do it. They're unable to do it. They don't have a relationship with themselves. How the hell can they have a relationship with anybody else? They really don't. They're strangers to themselves, for real. And it's sad, but you can't be a party of that. You can't acquiesce to that. And don't think the medication is going to do a damn thing, because it doesn't. All it's doing is putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound, and I am completely opposed to any medication for cluster Bs. They need to get in there and face their crap and get therapy. They do not need to try to medicate their crap away, because all that does is give them less reason to have therapy so they can hold on to their stuff and just pop a pill.
Got it.
That's what most of them do.
Fair enough. Okay, so in summary, we hope now that our listeners better understand what is meant when we refer to cluster B disorders and what the individual terms and pathologies within it mean. So we hope we not only can help with pop culture misunderstandings, but also with coping mechanisms as a patient or as a loved one of a patient with cluster B issues. So this concludes our show on cluster Bs, narcissists, antisocials, histrionics, and borderlines. This is part two of a two-part episode. Last time was part one. On behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later, podcast, iTunes, etc. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion on Wednesday, June 26th. At 11 p.m. EDT, right here on Blog Talk Radio. We'd like to give a shout out to our other NDB Media shows coming up in the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow, Thursday night, the 13th at 8 p.m., is Travel Itch Radio. Hate to leave River behind when you travel? According to travel photojournalist and author Tanya Willem, traveling with your dog is getting easier by the day. Hear her tips on canine travel on the June 13th edition of Travel Itch Radio with Dan Schlossberg. On Sunday the 16th at 8:30 p.m., I will be hosting Fear the Walking Dead online viewing party, Season 5, Episode 3. The episode is called Humbug's Gulch. And the following Sunday, the 23rd, at 8:30 p.m., Fear the Walking Dead, Season 5, Episode 4. The episode is called Skidmark. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody, and rock on. Thank you.